Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to once again revisit the background to the Balkans War, and specifically, we're going to take a look at the U.S. involvement in the breakup of Yugoslavia between 1990 and 1995. The following is excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of May 23rd, 1999.
We're going to continue with a reading of this particular paper presented by T.W. Bill Carr, Associate Publisher, Defense and Foreign Affairs Publications in London. This is presented at a symposium on the Balkan War entitled Yugoslavia Past and Present, held in Chicago on August 31st and September 1st of 1995. It's entitled German and U.S. Involvement in the Balkans, A Careful Coincidence of National Policies. And I've read a nice chunk of this document into a couple of half-hour segments, and those segments are available from Spitfire. This next section is entitled German Actions Destabilize Yugoslavia and the U.S. Steps in to Assist. A major destabilizing effect of Germany's recognition of Croatia came on the day after, on December 24th, 1991. The Serb areas within the administrative boundaries of Croatia exercised their right to self-determination. By the way, bear in mind the treatment accorded Serbs who had remained within Croatia. They rebelled, and then Croatian attempts at suppressing that rebellion were backed by the U.S. and Germany. Something very similar happened in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Skipping down, we read, 4 days after the formation of the Bosnian Muslim Army, President Izet Begovic ordered his troops to attack all the barracks of the Yugoslav Army in Bosnia. 2 weeks later, the Yugoslav government declared it would respect the territorial integrity of Bosnia-Herzegovina and that the Yugoslav National Army would commence to withdraw to Serbia on May 19th. All the Yugoslav National Army had withdrawn by June 6th of 1992. Despite the JNA clearly demonstrating that it was withdrawing, on May 30th, the UN, led by the U.S. and Germany, branded Yugoslavia the aggressor in Bosnia-Herzegovina and in the disputed territory on the Croatian-Serb border. No account was taken by the U.S. and Germany of the fact that the JNA, again that's Yugoslavian National Army, had withdrawn from its barracks in Slovenia and Macedonia and was halfway through a withdrawal from Bosnia-Herzegovina. Yugoslavia was still branded the aggressor. Later on the same day, May 30th, 1992, the UN Security Council adopted Resolution 757, imposing economic sanctions on Yugoslavia, and at that point that was just Serbia and Montenegro. On July 2nd, the Bosnian Croats, who accounted for 17% of the population of Bosnia-Herzegovina, declared a separate state within Bosnia-Herzegovina, calling it Croatia, Herceg Bosnia. This territory rapidly became a part of Greater Croatia, adopting the same flag, currency, car number plates, etc. as used in Croatia, and Croatian government troops were deployed in this part of Bosnia-Herzegovina. No action has ever been taken against Croatia by the United Nations in respect to these flagrant acts of aggression, a sharp contrast to Yugoslavia, which suffers UN sanctions despite having no troops deployed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The U.S. and Germany again took the lead against Serbia by taking action at the UN with the passing of UN Resolution 816 on October 9, 1992, declaring the airspace above Bosnia-Herzegovina to be a no-fly zone. The U.S. said the objective was to prevent munitions and war supplies from reaching all three sides and to prevent airstrikes being employed by one side against another. However, because the Bosnian Serbs had by far the largest air force, the real effect impinged on one side only. In addition, the no-fly zone was used by the U.S. to allow the Bosnian Muslim and Croat forces to use helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft without them being attacked by Bosnian fighter aircraft. Between October 1992 and today, UN observers have reported thousands of violations of the no-fly zone, the vast majority by Bosnian Muslim and Croatian aircraft, and yet only Bosnian Serb aircraft, airfields, radars, and communication centers have been targeted by NATO aircraft. It should not be forgotten that within the NATO structure in the region, most of the senior officers in control of air and naval operations are U.S. personnel, and the aircraft used in the airstrikes have been predominantly U.S. The next section of this paper details three separate attempts to control the government in Belgrade by the United States. And this is entitled, appropriately enough, U.S. Attempted Three Times to Control Belgrade. As noted earlier, the perception in the U.S. is that Belgrade is the last bastion of communism in Europe, and that President Milosevic of Serbia is the last communist leader holding power in Europe. By the way, I would interject that after the bombing campaign in March of 1999 was undertaken, Bill Clinton has made some similar statements by way of defending the policy. Continuing, as a result of these perceptions, constantly reinforced by Germany, the U.S. has taken a number of actions to gain control of Yugoslavia, and in so doing, to unseat President Milosevic. In July of 1992, with the blessing and backing of the U.S. State Department and an invitation from the Yugoslav leadership, a naturalized U.S. citizen, Milan Panic, P-A-N-I-C, returned to Belgrade. He had left Serbia in the early 1950s as a poor young man and carved out a multi-million dollar pharmaceutical business empire in California. Milan Panic was therefore the embodiment of the American dream and a potent symbol for capitalism over communism. Accompanied by a host of U.S. advisors, his mission appeared to be that of peacemaker, with the Yugoslav leadership hoping that his presence in their capital would result in better relations with the United States and the lifting of U.N. sanctions. On July 14, 1992, while still a U.S. citizen, Mr. Panic was appointed as the first prime minister of the new Yugoslavia. Under U.S. law, citizens of the U.S. are not permitted to hold office in or participate in any foreign government. In the past, people even voting in a foreign election have lost their U.S. citizenship. Yet Milan Panic was allowed by the U.S. State Department to become the prime minister of Yugoslavia, a country on which the U.S. had been the prime mover in imposing U.N. sanctions. It can only be assumed, as subsequent events seem to confirm, that the State Department hoped Mr. Panic would displace communist leader Mr. Milosevic, after which Mr. Panic would be in a strong position to terminate the Balkans conflict on U.S. and German terms and bring Yugoslavia under U.S. and German economic influence. On August 11, 1992, Mr. Panic made his first tentative move to sideline President Milosevic. Together with the then recently elected Yugoslav President Mr. Dobrica Kosic, COSIC, Prime Minister Panic met with Lord Owen and Cyrus Vance in Geneva. By the way, this again is August 11th of 1992. George Bush is still in office, and note again the continuity of policy with regard to the Balkans from Bush to Clinton. Continuing, following the meeting, a joint statement was issued on future Yugoslav relations with Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. It varied somewhat with previous positions adopted by President Milosevic. On September 1st, Prime Minister Panic startled the Yugoslav population by stating during a Belgrade TV interview, quote, "The world sees Mr. Milosevic as a man who does not keep his word," unquote. President Milosevic brought a vote of no confidence against Panic. On September 10, 1992, the Yugoslav foreign minister resigned his post during peace talks in Geneva, saying Mr. Panic was continuing to work against the interests of the Serbian people. Another vote of no confidence was brought against Mr. Panic in November, and though it failed by one vote in the upper chamber, it effectively crippled Mr. Panic's administration. The Yugoslav federal prime minister then made his third move, announcing he would run against Mr. Milosevic for the presidency of Serbia. Bear in mind, this guy, Panic, is a U.S. citizen. Continuing, at the election on December 20th, Mr. Milosevic polled 56.21% of the votes and Mr. Panic 33.95%. The remainder went to right-wing nationalist candidates. Many independent observers of the election said the U.S. government's transparent tactics of threatening the Serbs with military intervention if Mr. Panic was not elected backfired by pushing a large proportion of the population into voting for Mr. Milosevic. His mission a failure, Mr. Panic returned to the U.S. to pursue his business interests, and that was the first attempt to dominate Belgrade. Here is the second. This, by the way, now the transition has been made at this time to the administration of Bill Clinton. The second occasion took place when U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher visited Belgrade as part of his Round Europe diplomatic effort, made soon after President Clinton had taken over from President George Bush. Though his tone was diplomatic, nevertheless, he went to Belgrade more to preach and harangue rather than to listen to another point of view and to work more objectively. Interviewed by the U.S. CBS television network on March 28, 1993, Secretary of State Warren Christopher said, quote, "If the Bosnian Serbs do not sign, we will take measures to tighten sanctions against Serbia and Montenegro, increase humanitarian aid to Bosnia, take further steps for establishing an international war crimes tribunal, and hopefully have a resolution enforcing the no-fly zone in Bosnia next week." The U.S. is also considering a lifting of the embargo on delivering arms to Bosnian Muslims, unquote. The third time pressure was applied by the U.S. took place in April of 1993. In an attempt to show EC member states that strong talking and threats was the way to deal with Serbs, President Clinton sent to Belgrade a U.S. special peace envoy, Mr. Reginald Bartholomew, accompanied by State Department officials and senior U.S. Armed Forces officers. Their publicly stated mission was to hold discussions on how to progress the peace process with the Yugoslav government. On arrival, they tried to drive a wedge between the military and political leadership by insisting on separate meetings. At a series of meetings in a most confrontational manner, the Americans demanded the Bosnian Serbs be made to sign the Vance-Owen Plan immediately. At the meeting with the then Yugoslav National Army General Chief of Staff, General Ponic, that's a different Ponic here, spelled the same way, and his senior officers, the Americans made it very clear they had not come to negotiate. When the JNA officers tried to put forward the Serbian viewpoint, they were told to shut up and listen. The Americans said they were not interested in history and had come to deliver an ultimatum. The meeting was filled with threats of massive U.S. military action against Serbs throughout Yugoslavia unless the Yugoslav government agreed immediately to U.S. and U.N. terms for the peace settlement in Bosnia and Croatia. A senior U.S. officer was introduced as having a wide experience of the Vietnam War and that his armored units in the Gulf had destroyed 7 Iraqi armored divisions. The threat was made to send him to the Balkans to do a similar destruction job on the JNA. General Ponic explained that there were no JNA forces in Bosnia, but there were 40,000 Croatian government troops deployed in Bosnia, so he trusted the Americans would be even-handed and attack and destroy the Croatian invasion force in Bosnia. Skipping down, it perhaps needs no saying that the U.S. delegation left Belgrade without any concessions from the Yugoslav side. Throughout the remainder of 1993 and into 1994, while the EC and UN special envoys tried to achieve a peaceful resolution in the former Yugoslavia, Germany continued to supply arms to Croatia and the Bosnian Muslims. Other than Germany, EC member states resisted efforts to lift the arms embargo on only one side in the Bosnian Civil War. President Clinton, therefore, abandoned his efforts to lift the arms embargo on the Bosnian Muslims. It is clear now that the U.S. government changed tactics at this point. The next section is entitled U.S. Government Coordinates Croat and Muslim Actions Against the Serbs. Peace negotiations reconvened in Geneva during the second week of February of 1994, in an atmosphere charged with emotion and anti-Serb feelings as a result of the Markkali market explosion, claimed erroneously to be a Serb mortar shell. That's M-A-R-K-A-L-E. Prior to this round of talks in Geneva, President Clinton and his administration had made it clear that they had little faith in the EC-UN peace negotiating process. Quite remarkably, on February 11, 1994, in front of TV cameras in Geneva, U.S. Special Envoy to the Peace Talks, Charles Redmond, stood side-by-side with a very happy-looking Bosnian Prime Minister, Haris Zelazic, and declared that, quote, "The United States now intends to help the Bosnian Muslims get what they are demanding. We want to help the Bosnian government to come to a substantive settlement. We want to reinvigorate the negotiations and produce the results the Bosnians have been looking for," unquote. In plain English, Mr. Redmond was stating that the U.S. government is going to take sides in a civil war and is going to intervene in the internal affairs of another country taking the side of the Muslims against the Orthodox Christians. From this point on, it is possible to discern a much greater overt and covert U.S. involvement in Bosnia-Herzegovina in a pattern reminiscent of the early days of the Vietnam War. In addition to increasing the flow of arms to the Croats and Muslims, the U.S. went further and devised a policy to bring the Croats and Bosnian Muslims together in a coordinated strategy to defeat the Bosnian Serbs and the Krajina Serbs. In March of 1994, talks were held in Washington, D.C. between the Bosnian Muslim and Bosnian Croat leadership, accompanied by President Tudjman of Croatia. The two sides agreed to a ceasefire, the forging of a Croat-Muslim alliance, and the formation of a federal Bosnia, with the Bosnian-Croatian Republic confederated with Croatia itself. In May of 1994, I wrote in a Defense and Foreign Affairs publication that, quote, President Tudjman admitted that in return for agreeing to this proposal, the U.S. had promised that the Serbs in the Krajina and in other Croatian territories would be forced to concede the territories are part of Croatia. Pressure would be exerted by the U.S., using its influence in NATO and the UN Security Council, and its economic leverage with Russia, to force a settlement on the Krajina Serb Republic. Sanctions would remain on Yugoslavia as a means of pressuring President Milosevic into forcing the Krajina Serbs to agree to the U.S. position, unquote. And skipping down, I would add that right about the time this paper was being delivered, part of this U.S. program resulted in Operation Storm, and the Croatian army simply literally blitzkrieged the Krajina region and drove the Serbs out in a huge act of ethnic cleansing. By the way, that was discussed in FTR 48. And Germany's role in that, by the way, discussed in FTR 147 as well. Skipping down, we read of Bosnian Muslim arming prior to this joint Bosnian Muslim Croat offensive against the Serbs. When UN Protection Force troops tried to investigate, the Bosnian Muslim forces blocked all UN Protection Force operations in the Sarajevo area while they moved the weapons into position. At the same time, large numbers of Bosnian Muslim forces began to gather in the rear of the hills surrounding Sarajevo, and U.S.-built C-130 Hercules aircraft began to arrive at Tuzla Airport at a rate of about four a day. The transport aircraft were unmarked, but were manned by U.S. crews. The Bosnian Serbs recorded the crews' voices and say there is no doubt whatsoever that the crews were American. It is reported that the aircraft brought in arms and ammunition for use by the Bosnian Muslim forces gathering around Sarajevo. It is estimated that at least 90,000 troops arrived, including the very best Muslim Special Forces units, with the exception of the Bosnian 5th Corps Special Forces, which remained at Bihać. Despite protests made by the Bosnian Serb government, no action was taken against the heavy weapons sited within the exclusion zone and the UN safe haven of Sarajevo, which should be a demilitarized city. As an act of provocation designed to trigger NATO airstrikes against the Bosnian Serb forces, Bosnian Muslim snipers killed two UN Protection Force soldiers serving with the French contingent in Sarajevo. However, this event happened during the French presidential campaign, which overshadowed media coverage of the killing, plus the fact that UN Protection Force commanders no longer attribute all such killings to the Bosnian Serbs. UN Protection Force commanders on the spot now seem to display a much more questioning attitude towards events that occurred just before a significant stage in the peace process. This questioning attitude, however, seems to have little effect in achieving more objective news coverage of events that happened within the UN safe havens. Emotive TV reporting of another alleged Serb mortar attack on Sarajevo, in which more than 30 people have died, is being shown even as this paper was written. By the way, that attack turns out not to have been by a Serb shell, and it nonetheless was used as an excuse for the resumption of NATO bombing. And this again in August of 95, that bombing in conjunction with the Croatian and Bosnian Muslim offensive. Continuing, on May 3rd, 1995, the Bosnian Muslim troops launched a major offensive at 0600 hours, and at 1000 hours, NATO airstrikes were made against Bosnian Serb positions ahead of the Bosnian Muslim advance. The aircraft making the strikes were mainly U.S. Air Force F-16 fighters, supported by U.S. Air Force F-111s, reportedly acting in an air defense suppression role. In addition, the Bosnian Serb forces say that a small number of French, Spanish, and Dutch aircraft took part in the airstrikes. The airstrikes ceased only after the Bosnian Serbs took UN troops hostage. Bosnian Serb intelligence says that the hostages were only handcuffed to posts for a very brief period to allow TV cameras to film footage for distribution in the West. All those involved were well treated. On Spain's National Day, Spanish TV filmed their troops held hostage telephoning home to parents, wives, and girlfriends. The British troops said they had been well treated and that they understood the military situation which caused their detention. However, on their way out through Serbia and since, they have not been permitted to make any comment to the media. There then follows a description of the severe losses that were incurred by the Bosnian Muslim forces in this first offensive in May of 1995. That was because the Serbs had actually found a copy of the invasion plan and were able to take countermeasures. Even after losing tremendous numbers of troops, however, continued to press the offensive. Skipping down, we read, they gave orders immediately for the Muslim units in the enclaves to launch attacks from Srebrenica, Goražde, Tuzla, and Bihać. From Srebrenica, they launched three attacks in early June in which 12 Serbs were killed and many houses burned. They made another two attacks from Srebrenica and Zepa using about 640 troops. The villages were not expecting the attack, and many Serbs were killed. From Goražde, they made two attacks called Roda Chica and burned Serb villages. In Goražde, the Muslims surrounded the Ukrainian UN Protection Force unit and took their weapons and armored personnel carriers. From Tuzla, there were three attacks made toward Majevica, and from Bihać, the Muslim Special Forces made four attacks in the direction of Petrovac and one towards Novi Grad. And then more description of what a Yugoslavian officer felt was the Muslim tactics here, skipping down. He concluded by saying, the Muslims wanted to provoke us into attacking the enclaves so that the Muslim government could demand that NATO protect the safe havens with airstrikes and use the rapid reaction force to fight Bosnian Serbs at Goražde, Zepa, Srebrenica, etc. Because the Muslims lost heavily at Sarajevo using an American strategy, I believe the Muslims expected the Americans to use NATO airstrikes to punish Serbs. I don't think we've seen the end yet. We are awaiting another Muslim offensive and another staged incident by the Muslims on Muslims in order to give the Americans an excuse to send in NATO warplanes. By the way, that turned out to be prophetic. Just such an attack had taken place right about the time that was being spoken. Right about the time this paper was being delivered, excuse me, this obviously hadn't been spoken before that. And then the author T.W. Bill Carr writes in the summary of his paper, in conclusion, I would just like to say that I think the recent ethnic cleansing of more than 250,000 Krajina Serbs, and before that, of some 13,000 Serbs from West Slavonia, has shown to the world the true face of Croatia today. It bears striking similarities to the face it showed in 1941, with Germany as midwife on both occasions. The difference this second time is that the United States of America has abandoned its ally of two major world wars, Serbia, and has chosen instead to back a former enemy and its satellite states on the one hand, that of course referring to Germany, and its most dangerous current enemy, radical Islamist fundamentalism, on the other. Significantly, even President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, a Muslim state, opposed the U.S. by saying recently that the arms embargo against Bosnia-Herzegovina should not be lifted. Egypt knows full well that Islamism, radical, political terrorism using the face of Islam to legitimize itself, is no friend of the moderate Islamic states, nor of the West. The United States will find in the not-too-distant future that its actions in the former Yugoslavia have opened a green route for Islamic fundamentalists into the heart of Europe, a route down which drugs are already flowing in increasing quantities. This paper, again, in German and U.S. involvement in the Balkans, a careful coincidence of national policies, authored and presented by T.W. Bill Carr, Associated Publisher, Defense and Foreign Affairs Publications of London, presented at a symposium on the Balkan War entitled Yugoslavia, Past and Present, that held in Chicago on August 31st and September 1st of 1995. And again, that'll give people an idea of some of the background of the conflict in Yugoslavia. This and the various half-hour segments that I've recorded over the years are available from a tape duplication service along with the weekly One Step Beyond shows from my home base station, KFJC-FM, in the San Francisco Bay Area, the all-important archive documentary programs, and tapes of many of the lectures that I've done over the years as well. That tape duplication service is called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Again, that's Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire webpage. That's at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T. Once again, www.spitfirelist.com. And that website, by the way, is equipped with real audio. People can hear the three-hour program that I do on my home base stations, KFJC-FM. I do that on 7 to 10 p.m. on Sunday nights, Pacific Standard Time, as well as on 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday evenings, Pacific Standard Time. You can hear that on the KFJC website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.